Hello, this is Caleb Keith, the director of the 1517 Podcast Network, with an important announcement from the network to you. During the month of June, your favorite podcasts from 1517 are going to be participating in a podcast fundraiser. During this time, we are seeking to raise $50,000 for the 1517 podcasts. The 1517 Podcast Network has created free gospel-centered content for over 5 years. We have new episodes of our 19 podcasts coming out every day of the week, and we never fill them with ads or place them behind a paywall. That's why this June, we're asking listeners across our shows to support 1517 and the teachers and creators behind your favorite theological resources. Your support directly impacts our ability to build and maintain podcast content that was listened to over 6 million times last year alone. Thank you to the listeners who enjoy and share our podcast. A special thanks to those who financially support our shows. We hope that you consider supporting this podcast and the rest of the network during our June fundraiser. And again, that goal is $50,000. One of the easiest ways you can help is by signing up for a monthly recurring donation. All you have to do is follow the Support This Show link at the top of the show notes or go to 1517.org/donate-podcasts to support your favorite shows. Again, we appreciate your support. Enjoy this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out everything else that 1517 is doing. One of the things we're doing right now, Chad, we're doing that Podcast Network fundraiser. This is going on, you know, just this month of June. And what you get to do, what you have an opportunity to do, dear listener, is support not just this show, of course this show, but all the shows that are on the podcast network. That's 20-plus shows that you're supporting when you support the podcast network fundraiser. And so what you have to do is you can go to the show notes, and you can just click the link that says support this show or support the podcast network. You click that link, and it'll take you to a way to support it. And you can do that through a reoccurring donation. You can do that through a one-time donation, however you want to do it. We thank you very much to those who have done that, those of you who are going to do that, those who have done that for a long time. It is what makes us able to do this and makes it to where we don't have to try to come up with ways to get the funds to do the stuff that we do. And those ways would be advertisements or paywalls, you have to have a subscription or something to access, past episodes or something like that. That's how that stuff all stays free for whoever wants to check it out. And so thank you so much. And if you are able to, we would appreciate the support. All right, Chad, we are in Nehemiah chapter 5. And Nehemiah's got to do some in-house work. Right now he's been building the house. He's had some opposition from outside the house. But everyone's, got a shield and everyone's got a sword or a spear or something like that. And you got people that are working, with one eye on, anyone that would come and try to stop their work. And the work seems to have been going good. The people they were intimidated for a little bit, but that seemed to have waned, and they're building this thing. And you'd love it if it was just like, and then they built the city, the gates were all restored, the walls were rebuilt, and bam, everything was great, because look at the unity. And the thing about this is that, and we talked about this last episode, it was kind of nice to see in the sort of history of Israel. It was kind of nice to see like everyone pitching in and everyone's gathered around this common cause. And it's you kind of did have this sort of moment of singular purpose and unity. And it was kind of nice to see. It doesn't seem that harmonious thing was super long lived.
Yeah, or, as we have in other cases in the Bible, you kind of get the impression when you're reading through one chapter, it's like, oh, man, these people, I mean, they are all all united around this common effort. There's no problems whatsoever. And then you read the next chapter and you're like, oh, well, maybe that wasn't the complete picture. You know, you get the same thing when you read the book of Acts. You're like, man, those early Christians, they're selling property. They're sharing everything. Just wonderful unity. And then you read another couple chapters, you're like, oh, well, yeah. Maybe it was a little bit too rosy of a picture at first. Maybe there were some more things going on beneath. Maybe there's unity over building project or unity over this or that. But yeah, there's always underlying, you know, skirmishes, disagreements, hurt feelings, all that kind of stuff going on. And that's what's happening here. Yeah, you read through Nehemiah 4 and they're all united in this common purpose. They got a common enemy. They got a common goal. Everything's going great. And then you open up chapter 5 and you realize, oh, wait, there's some more things going on. And like you said, these are issues that Nehemiah is going to have to deal with straight away and in a pretty forceful sort of way, too.
You know, I think Chad, we were talking before this because in 30 minutes in the New Testament, the New Testament companion to the show, we're going through James, and I was talking about one of the big things in James letter, the thing that's really got, you know, it's really a pebble in James' shoe, is this sin of partiality, and he really is upset about the way that the church is sort of engaging in what is super common in the world at that time, and obviously in this time as well, and this sort of classist structure, and they're letting that come into the church as well. And so whatever your station is outside of the church, well, they're treating you like that inside the church, which of course is not what you're supposed to do in the church. What's the old saying, that the ground is level at the foot of the cross, right? So in the church, you come in as all sinners and needing forgiveness. You come in as brothers. I mean, this is a big thing that's interesting about the church, is that you call the people brother and sister, no matter what their station in life is. And classism was, of course, a huge thing. It wasn't even viewed as a bad thing. It's just the way things were. In this context, you sort of have like the same thing, and you realize that this is actually something that the people of God have struggled with forever. Is this sort of partiality and this kind of stuff? And one of the reasons I bring it up is because one of the things that's common language in the Old Testament too is this language of brothers, right? And so there is supposed to be some semblance of equality because you are of the same people. But that does not stop people from sort of showing this kind of partiality. And if you read the Old Testament prophets, or if you read the New Testament and you read the letters of the church, it does seem that this is one thing that, like, God really doesn't like this.
I was discussing this recently with people about the whole inner conversation Jesus has with the young man who's rich. And Jesus says, you know, sell all your possessions and then come follow me. And that's when you have the whole camel through the eye of a needle conversation. And the disciples were astonished. Mm-hmm. And they were astonished because they assumed that, hey, if this guy's rich, he's blessed by God. And so if he can't be saved, then who can be saved? There's a lot of layers to the idea, layers to the problem here. You have just kind of the economic disparity. You have the attention, I guess, disparity that you might point out in James, where the rich are shown favoritism. And then in this case, in Nehemiah, you not only have kind of this different ways of treating people, but the haves are actually taking advantage of the have-nots, and they're reducing them to an even lower status by kind of taking advantage of the fact that there's famine going on. There's the men are not able to work back on the farm because they're taking care of the wall building. And as we see in verse 1, really what kind of brings this to a head, it seems to me, is that the wives get involved. And they are not happy about the situation. I mean, they're explicitly pointed out as some who bring this outcry about what's going on. So let's kind of start out here. Verse 1 of chapter 5 says, there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. So what's this outcry about? Well, we have basically three different groups. And each of these are introduced by, there were those who said. So first of all, there were those who said, with our sons and daughters, we are many, so let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive. And then verse 3, there were also those who said, well, we're foraging in our fields and our vineyards and our houses to get grain because of the famine. And then verse 4 is the third group. And there were those who said, well, we had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. So those are the three groups. Basically, you have what seems to be people who are what we would say today living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have any land, so they have no collateral. They don't have anything that they can put out in order to get a loan. So, and they're big families. They say, with our sons and our daughters, we are many. We got these big families, and we have to have something to eat. So we got to get some grain in order we can make bread and stay alive. Then you got the second group, those who said, well, we have fields and we got vineyards and we got houses, but we're having to mortgage these. We're having to basically put these up as collateral to people who do have some money so that we can get some grain because of the famine that's going on. And then the third group, they had to borrow money to pay the tax, the Persian tax on their fields and on their vineyards. So they're all kind of in the same situation. There's people who live in paycheck to paycheck and they have big families and everybody's hungry. And there were others who had to put their fields up for collateral, their land up for collateral. And then there were those who were, you know, they can't even pay their taxes. And so they have to borrow money because of that. And where are they getting the money? What are they being forced to do? That's what we read about in verse 5. It says, now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. Our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but it's not in our power to help it. For other men have our fields and our vineyards. So that's kind of the big situation, as well as kind of the individual situations within this bigger problem. But the problem is basically that you've got these people, these families, where the men are busy building the wall. They're not able to be on the tractor, they're not able to take care of things back at home because they're in the city. And as we read in chapter 4, Nehemiah is even enforcing them to stay at the city. They can't even go back home. So they're in the city, they're defending and they're building, they're busy with this. And all the while, their crops are suffering, their families are suffering, and their wives in particular are bringing this to the forefront because they're basically left alone. They got all these kids and they're trying to take care of things at home. And now, you know, in order to pay debts, they're going to be forced to sell their kids into at least a temporary slavery in order to pay debts, or you know, they might lose everything. If they do have land, they've had to put it up as collateral. Well, if they can't pay it back, then they're going to lose it, and then they're going to be destitute too. And the real culprit here, as we'll see in the rest of the chapter, are the richer Jews who are taking the lands as collateral, who may be then taking also these children as their slaves, and are basically not acting like brothers, but they're treating their fellow Israelites like they would Gentiles instead of treating them like brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I mean, if you take this to sort of a church context, this would be like if someone needed something from you, and you said, "Well, and I'll tell you what. Like, let me help you out. Here's the most insane interest rate in the history of the world. Just let me take your kid out of your house, and he can work for me for the next 15 years, and we'll call it even." There is, and you're doing this to people who are supposed to be your family.
Yeah, they're supposed to be your family. They're supposed to be the ones that you especially look out for, that you take care of. Poverty was a huge focus of the Torah. You're never supposed to abuse a poor person. Instead, you are to treat them with special respect and special care. That's a situation that has arisen during the course of the 52 days that's required to build the wall. We haven't got to the 52 days part. That's going to come up in the next chapter. It takes 52 days to complete the wall. So a lot happens in a short amount of time. And maybe this was building, you know, before they actually started working on the wall. It probably was a long time in coming to a head. And Nehemiah, in the section we're about to look at, he finds out what's going on, or maybe at least is brought to his full attention what's going on. And he realizes that he's going to have to deal with it. He's going to have to deal with it straight away before matters get any worse than they already are.
You know what's interesting about the Bible and the way it treats sort of poverty and the idea that there will be those who have and those who don't is you have Jesus who like is really helpful in this statement where he says, hey, the poor you will always have with you. And so The Bible's real honest about the idea that there will always be people who have less, right? This is the way it is. So the poor you'll always have with you. And at the same time, the scripture is very clear that God like really, really doesn't like it when you mistreat the poor you will always have with you. So there will always be this group of people, and God will always be very irritated if you mistreat them.
Yeah, he threatens that, if you upset a poor person, if you deprive them of the very little that they do have, when their prayers come to me, I will hear those.
Yeah.
and I will act. So these are not just empty words, empty threats. God means these words. So there's never any kind of a, socialist program where everybody's supposed to be, on equal footing. There's a very much of a realism in the scriptures. Yeah, you're always going to have poor people. You're always going to have rich people. You're always going to have people in between. What matters is how you treat the people who don't have as much as you have, and how you are to treat them is precisely what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Not as a stranger, not as someone that you can take advantage of, but instead how you would treat your own sibling, how you would treat your own brother. And that explains why in verse 6, Nehemiah, in his own words, this is often referred to, by the way, I don't think I mentioned this before. If you check the commentaries, I'll talk about the Nehemiah memoir, where he kind of collected a bunch of information. And some of these are just kind of lists. Some of these are almost read like genealogies, but list of people who came and this and that is inserted here. But interspersed with that is the Nehemiah memoir, where he's speaking in first person, as we'll see later in this chapter, even include what he did in love and faithfulness to the people of Israel. So here he records, verse 6, his reaction. I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words, which is what you would expect from Nehemiah. I mean, everything we've kind of got to know about him, he comes across as a person who has some pretty intense emotions about things. He's going to react, and he's going to act in a way that tries to fix the situation that he's upset about. So he's angry when he hears about this outcry, and it's kind of like between verse 6 and 7, it's almost like he has a cooling off period. So he finds out and he's really mad, but he doesn't immediately act. He says, verse 7, I took counsel with myself. So he sits down and he thinks through this. All right, this is wrong. I'm upset about this, but how am I going to deal with it? Of course, there's lots of ways he could have dealt with it. He seems to approach it in a way that is level-headed and not overly or at least overtly angry, but he tries to appeal to the perpetrators here in a way that is consistent with the Torah, as well as consistent just kind of with human compassion and this brotherly sense that Israel has.
I like this phrase, I took counsel with myself, because on one hand, that sounds like, so then I got with myself and we decided, me, myself, and I.
I had a meeting with me, myself, and I, and we talked through things.
Yeah, but I think what this is like really supposed to say, like I took counsel with myself. I think this is like I was super angry, so I went and sat down, calmed down, and thought through it and came up with a plan. Now, it is interesting that he doesn't go to anyone else and to ask them what they should do. How are we going to deal with this or anything like that? But it does seem like, so yeah, I had to have this moment where I talked to myself, because maybe who knows what his first impulse was going to be. Maybe it was going to be, he's pretty mad. So it could have been too much. Could have been too rash.
Well, later in the book, he does drag people around by the hair. So
maybe
he should have taken counsel with himself in that situation.
Yeah. So I just imagine him like sitting down, or who knows, maybe he went for a walk. And he's like, all right, calm down. What's going to be the best way to handle this?
Yeah. And haven't we all done that? You get really irritated over something. And, maybe your first impulse is to make a phone call and chew somebody out, or, send a fiery email to somebody. But you you said, you take a walk. Well, we first of all hear very much of a kind of official legal tone to it. I got some charges. I got some accusations that I'm going to bring against the nobles and the officials. Now, that tells you that these aren't just rich people, in other words. These are people in positions of leadership over the people of God. So nobles and officials. Those are the ones that charge is going to be brought against. So they're taking advantage not only the fact that they have more affluence than the others do, but also the fact that they have these leadership roles where they can use their own power to their own benefit. She says, I said to them, and here the opinions vary on this. ESV has, you are exacting interest. Opinions vary because that's not the typical word for interest that's used elsewhere in the scriptures. It can mean that here. It can mean kind of a maybe an excessive burden that that is being laid upon them. But whatever it is, whether they're exacting interest or whether it's a case of an excessive burden they're laying on the peoples, what they're doing is they're doing this against their brothers. So you're exacting interest, or you're laying these oppressive burdens upon those that you are to treat as your brothers. And that's just kind of a summary statement. We're going to hear more about it as he goes on. So he gets everybody together. He's not going to deal with this, you know, one-on-one. He's going to bring everybody together. I held a great assembly against them. And here's what he said. This is verse 8. We, as far as we're able, have bought back our Jewish brothers who have been sold to the nations. But you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us. So it's kind of, he's like, think through what you're doing here. You know, all of our Jewish brothers and sisters who have been sold into slavery to the Gentiles, what are we doing? Well, we're doing everything that we can, everything within our ability to buy them back from their Gentile overlords. Now, what are you doing? Well, you're turning around and you're selling your brothers that they may be sold to us. Now, what sense does this make? You know, we're trying to get everybody out of slavery, and what you're doing is putting them into slavery instead. And their response, I love their response. They were silent and couldn't find a word to say. Now, if you're bringing charges against someone and that's their reaction, well, then I would say you're doing a pretty good job of it. Because typically, you know, people, well, they're extenuating circumstances, or they say, well, you know, if you read the law in this sort of way, then we are able to do this and not break the Torah of Moses. But nothing. They know they're guilty, and their guilt, when it's pointed out, actually silences him, which, you know, that's great. Nehemiah made a good argument, and credit to them. At least they recognize the problem that they have created.
Yeah. I mean, this is like him saying, hey, our whole project here is to sort of as a captive people and of people who have been, you know, in exile, in bondage, and are still like have like sort of a, you know, a king over them. But our whole the whole project here is to certainly maximize as much freedom as we can for our people. And you're over here buying and selling people. Like what is this is contrary to everything we're trying to do here.
Yeah, we're breaking the chains of our people, and then you're turning around and putting them right back on. So you're undermining all of our efforts in emancipation here. So they're silent and could not find a word to say. So Nehemiah is not quite done. Verse 9 says he goes on to say something else. The thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? So it's kind of an interesting argument. And we actually hear that argument a lot. All the way from the days of Moses onward. You know, when Moses reminds God, when God wants to destroy the people of Israel, like after the golden calf, and Moses begins to intercede, one of the arguments that Moses makes, and you hear this elsewhere in the scriptures, is that, hey, if you do this, then that's not going to make you look very good in the eyes of the nations. this is not the image that you want to present before the world. And it's kind of like that with Nehemiah here. He's like, hey, if you do this, if you don't walk in the fear of God, then our enemies, the nations, are going to use this to taunt us, to throw shade on us. They'll be like, look at those Jews. You know, they don't even care about their own people. So what kind of God do they have when they're behaving in this sort of way and enslaving their own people, selling their own people into slavery? So instead, Nehemiah says, walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations. And as we pointed out many times in the podcast, you know, to fear God or to walk in the fear of God doesn't simply mean that you are in trepidation before him, you know, trembling before God. Fear is often used as a synonym for faith in the Old Testament. So as well as hope and love, it's kind of an all-encompassing term. So walk in the fear of God means to believe in, act in faith toward God. And then as a fruit of that, of course, is love. So love your, by walking in the fear of God, by walking in the faith of God, then you're acting in love toward your neighbor. Verse 10, he goes on, rather than taking from them, we're lending them money and grain. So let us abandon this exacting of interest. Verse 11, return to them this very day, their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchard, and their houses, and the percentage, literally the 100th, which probably either that Hebrew term either refers to percentage in general, or maybe some scholars argue that it's like a 1% per month is kind of the idea. And then over the course of the year, it'd be 12%. But either way, he says, return to them that percentage or that 1% of money, grain, wine, and oil that you've been exacting from them. So that's his proposal. He says, first of all, you guys need to, all the stuff that you have taken, give it back. Cancel all the debts, cancel all the interest. And in the future, abandon this form of kind of, you know, taking fields and vineyards and whatever as collateral. And instead, treat them like you would your brothers and sisters. Treat them as those who are in need and those that you act in compassion toward. And I guess it's important, I guess, at this point also to point out something we covered a lot years ago when we were talking about Exodus and Leviticus, and that is that according to the Torah, the Israelites could loan money to the Gentiles and exact interest from them. That was allowed. So the Israelites could loan money to whoever it was, a non-Israelite, and receive interest on that. However, both, I think, three different times, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy say that if they are loaning money to a fellow Israelite, then they cannot charge interest on that. And that's, of course, referred to typically as usury. So interest to non-Israelites, yes. Interest to Israelites, no. And that was very different from anything in the ancient world. There's all sorts of law codes that we have. Law Code of Hammurabi is one example where there are very strict laws given about the exacting of interest, how much you can charge. And, you know, maybe there's a disaster, a famine or something, then the lender is not able to impoverish the person that borrowed money from them. So there's a lot of different laws about lending and borrowing. But every single one of these ancient cultures did allow for the charging of interest. And Israel alone, at least as far as we know, Israel alone did not allow for the charging of interest against a fellow citizen. So you could borrow money and, you know, you could sell yourself into slavery if you needed to pay debts. But what a lender could not do was to charge interest. And of course, there were plenty of instances where this law was not kept, both in the Bible as well as throughout history. But that was the law. No charging of interest to your fellow Israelites. You could charge interest, though, to the Gentiles.
I think part of, too, that just, you know, if you're going to fear the Lord, that would be, you know, if you're going to trust the Lord, there is no need for you to do these things. So I think in Nehemiah's mind, like, charging interest that you're not supposed to charge, or selling someone, you know, making someone your slave, these things are contrary to trusting God. This is trying to take care of yourself when you should be in a position where you say, I'm going to help my brother or my sister because I trust that God is going to take care of my needs. I don't need to sort of hoard up, especially at the expense of my neighbor. This is an act of distrust in God.
Yeah, trust is at the core of the issue here. I mean, you trusted God to bring you out of captivity, which he did. You trusted God to help you build the wall, which he did. So trust him also in the future to care for you and you know, to use you to care for those who are in need, who are around you. And so, you know, rather than trust, they're simply taking advantage of the situation in order to line their own pockets, and in so doing, abusing their brethren.
Yep.
So verse 12, Nehemiah is done, more or less. So what are the people were silent before. So what are they going to say now? We will restore these and require nothing from them. We will do as you say. That's a response to basically say, okay.
As good as that's as good as that can go. You're making that argument.
I mean, could it have gone any better? I mean, that's pretty perfect. They don't produce any kind of arguments. They don't say, well, what about this or what about that? They basically say, you're right, we're wrong. And not only that, but we're not only going to stop what we're doing, but we're going to give back all the money we've been taking, and we're not going to engage in this activity anymore. Now, Nehemiah wants to make sure that they're serious about this, so he calls for the priest. And I guess they're the witnesses here. That's the way that I read this anyway. Called the priest and made them swear to do them. I think he's referring back to the lenders. Made them, that is the lenders, swear to do as they had promised. So, you know, you call in the priest, kind of add a little bit of authority here as witnesses to the oath. We have kind of one of these prophetic signs, I guess is what you would call it. Nehemiah takes his garment, this long garment that would have had pockets, I suppose, here and there, and he shook it out. I shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out every man from his house and from his labor who does not keep his promise. So may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen to that, and praise the Lord. And the people did as they had promised.
He brings in the priests. Maybe this isn't right, but it seems like, so he brings in, you know, sort of the, you know, the religious guys. I mean, not that Nehemiah is not a religious guy, but, you know, he brings in the church, as it were, and says, okay, these guys are going to make an oath to do this stuff. I want you guys to hear it. And this does a couple of things, I think. One, it amplifies that you're like, that you're making this promise before God, that God is witnessing, because now you've got the priests there, right? So they're going to be the eyes of God in this situation. They're going to see you and the ears of God and hear you make this promise. So you've got the religious leaders there. Also, you sort of have this. I don't know. Is there a little threat of? All right, you said you're going to do this. Yeah, I don't want to, like, these guys all see it. Like, I'm not going to want to see you at any rebuilt temple if you don't do this. I mean, there's a sort of, like, excommunication threat as you, like, make this promise in front of the priests. And if they find out you haven't, I expect them to, you know, do what has to be done. And this could mean maybe you're not welcome there until this is done. It seems
to be implied. Yeah, it really does. Yeah, it's like, hey, see, it's a congregational setting, all right? You got a very wealthy member who's taking advantage of a very poor member. And this becomes known. And so you get together the pastor and the elders, right?
Yeah.
And you talk through the situation. And everybody now knows the situation. Everybody hears, you know, the rich guy says, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. I repent. Forgive me. And I'm going to make this right. And the pastor and the elders are there, and they hear the promise. So if the guy shows up at church the next Sunday and he hasn't done what he promised, well, there's going to be problems.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it
reads. Add to this, you know, there's the whole shaking of the robe to visualize exactly what God will do to you if you don't follow through what you promised to do.
Yeah. 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 That's how it reads. Like, there's like a, it's not just like stated, but it's there where you're like, man, you're promising this in front of God and the church. And, it just sort of amps up what it is that you're agreeing to do. And you really probably ought to follow through on it.
Yeah, I think after all that, I probably would.
Yeah.
Not only for the sake of making the promise, but of the threat that goes along with it. So that's the first 13 verses of chapter 5. We got a few more verses to cover, which I think we can do before the end of our 40 minutes here, because there's not a whole lot here. This is Nehemiah basically telling his readers, hey, this is what I did. I dealt with the situation. You know, you had these people who were taking advantage of the poor. Well, let me tell you how I, as the governor, took care of the people, and really even I would forego what was due to me in order to make sure that I could actually care for the people who were hungry and who were in need. So he says, verse 14, moreover, from that time, I was appointed to be their governor. This is the first time we've heard about this. So Nehemiah not only came from the king on this errand, but sometime along the way, he was also appointed to be governor of this little section of the vast Persian Empire. So he was appointed governor in the land of Judah from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king. So for a dozen years, he says, I was the governor. This is probably then, by the way, this is probably out of temporal sequence. This is him reflecting much later on. So for 12 years, this is what I did. And here's what I did. Here's what I didn't do. Neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. So we were allowed, you know, a certain amount of money to make sure that there was all this food on our table. Well, we didn't take that. Now, the former governors, the guys who were in office before me, oh, they did. They took advantage of this. They laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them their daily ration, 40 shekels of silver. So Nehemiah is saying, this was not a good situation before I arrived. You had these former governors, the people who were in office before me, they took full advantage of this. I mean, they were taxing the people. They were making sure they had all this food on their table that was provided by taking from their fellow Israelites. I didn't do that. In fact, even their servants, he said, lorded it over the people. I didn't do that. Why? Because of the fear of God. Because I fear God, I trust in him, and because of that, I'm acting in love and compassion toward those who were around me. So Nehemiah is basically saying he tried to set a new precedent here. It was a bad precedent before. When he took office, this is what he did. Verse 16, he says, I also persevered in the work on the wall. We acquired no land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. There were 150 guys at my table, Jews and officials, but besides those, whom it became its envoys from the nations who were around us. So he's providing food for a whole lot of people. And then in verse 18, he kind of spells this out. He says, here's what was prepared at my expense every day. An ox was butchered. You had sheep and you had birds. You had every 10 days, we had wine brought in abundance. Yet, for all this, for all which I provided, I did not demand the food allowance of the governor because the service was too heavy on the people already. They were already encumbered by taxation and by all these various expenses from the Persians, and I didn't want to take further advantage of them. And this probably indicates that Nehemiah was already independently wealthy. That's my guess. I mean, there's no way that you can do all of this unless you have some pretty deep pockets of your own. I mean, if he's providing food for all these people on an ongoing basis and basically saying, no, I don't want that part of my salary. I'm going to forego that. And I'm going to pay for all this out of my own pocket. Well, that sounds great in theory, but when it comes right down to it, the only way you can do that is if you yourself are already independently wealthy. So Nehemiah, I presume, was a well-off guy.
You know, either that cup-bearing is a lucrative gig, which maybe it is, or when he left, he was such a good cup-bearer that the king wanted to make sure that, you know, he was going to be okay wherever he went. I assume it's one of those two things, probably the latter.
He had a healthy endowment. Yeah, he was well taken care of. And so having done all this, he says, verse 19, he finishes up with this very short prayer. Remember for my good, oh my God, all that I have done for this people. So remember me. Remember all the ways in which I stopped everything described in the first part of that chapter and the good that I did in taking care of this people. And Nehemiah did. I mean, I don't know quite what to think of the gist of the prayer, but I suppose this is Nehemiah saying, as part of, he's writing it, he's not just praying this, he's writing it down. So it's his way of, I suppose, leaving behind a legacy for his readers to remember what he did for the Israelites while he was in office.
Well, I think that, you know, you might be like, oh, is that really what you do? Do you do good things and then ask God to, you know, remember those good things? The positive way to look at this is that the Nehemiah, and we're going to see in the very next chapter, that Nehemiah has enemies. The people of God have enemies. And Nehemiah is very aware of what happens when there's all kinds of unrighteousness and this kind of stuff, and you have enemies. Sometimes God just lets those enemies win. And I think what Nehemiah is doing here is to say, hey, I'm doing the best I possibly can. to have this be a just and an honoring society. I hope you remember that. That's what's happening. As we've talked about before, I mean, you're asking God to remember. You're asking him to act. And so should we need you to act, I hope you will remember that there were things that were out of order. We put those things in order, and we're not like the other nations. They're not perfect, obviously, but they're trying to be the type of people that are not like their forefathers who would refuse to hear the word of the Lord. And so I think it's probably something like that, if I'm looking at it in the best way, that he's saying, hey, I know bad stuff's coming eventually, and I hope you will treat us differently than when bad stuff came to the people who came before us, which they had bad stuff came for them, and you let it come for them.
Yeah, I think that's a good charitable way of reading it. And I think it's in accord with kind of the tone of the rest of Nehemiah, too. I mean, you put yourself back in the situation. I mean, they're fresh off, basically fresh off, not quite, but, you know, it wasn't long since the Babylonian exile took place. They're trying to get things rolling again. They're trying to get back on their feet, build a wall. They got the temple built, and they're not wanting to repeat the mistakes of their ancestors.
Yeah.
So let's worship God, let's fear God, and let's treat everybody according to the way the Torah lays it out, where we care for each other. We don't take advantage of each other. And Nehemiah is saying, hey, I did my best to accomplish that. So remember that, God, and remember your people, and take care of us while we're here trying to rebuild.
That's right. All right, man, that is it. We are out of time, and we will have to continue next week with chapter 6, where it's going to be a little conspiracy going on. Maybe this is exactly the sort of thing that Nehemiah is asking God to remember, if this such a thing should happen. Well, that conspiracy, we're going to find out more about next episode. I will see you then, Chad.
All right, we'll see you then.